Acatra Foundation presents the Acatra Dialogue, an exploration of the world's greatest thinkers and ideas. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Acatra AI.
Welcome. Today we're doing a deep dive into Nicholas Kristof.
Yeah, the renowned journalist, two-time Pulitzer winner. We're focusing on his memoir, Chasing Hope, A Reporter's Life, which came out in 2023.
And right away, that title grabs you, doesn't it? Chasing Hope.
It really does, because, I mean, this is a guy who has spent decades reporting from the absolute front lines of human suffering. Think Tiananmen Square, the genocide in Darfur, global poverty, sex trafficking.
Even the opioid crisis back home in the U.S. Just relentless exposure to tragedy.
So the big question is, why hope? How does someone immersed in all that darkness maintain, well, what he calls persistent optimism?
Exactly. That's our mission today. We want to understand his unique approach, moving beyond just observing to becoming this really empathetic witness. He kind of pioneered a journalism that doesn't just report, it demands action.
It's almost like journalism is advocacy.
In many ways, yes. And to understand that drive, you really have to go back to the beginning. His story has this fascinating duality.
Right, the farm in Oregon, Yamhill, Oregon.
Right.
A world away from the conflicts he'd later cover.
Totally. A small cherry and sheep farm. It sounds idyllic, almost.
So how does that beginning shape the international reporter?
Well, his parents were key. They were academics, highly educated. His father actually fled Europe during World War II. But they chose this farm life.
Deliberately.
Yeah, deliberately. And that gave Kristof this really interesting blend. On one hand, a very pragmatic, hands-on, dirt-under-the-fingernails work ethic from the farm.
Okay.
But on the other hand, because of his parents, this fierce intellectual curiosity, this idealism, it's like high-minded ideas grounded in, well, muddy reality.
That makes sense. That sort of practical idealism seems like a thread throughout his career.
It really is. He carried that perspective through Harvard, then Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar, where he studied law and, interestingly, Arabic.
And Oxford is also where he met a crucial figure in his life and work.
That's right. Cheryl Wudun. They met, collaborated, got married. They're famously the first married couple to win a Pulitzer Prize together for journalism. Their partnership is central.
And that shared Pulitzer came from covering a truly defining historical moment.
Mm-hmm. Tiananmen Square, 1989. The student protests in Beijing.
They were the New York Times bureau chiefs there at the time, right?
They were. And when the crackdown happened, they were among the very few Western journalists on the ground witnessing it all.
I can only imagine what that must have been like.
Intense. Their reporting captured not just the events, but the human element, the courage of the students, the sheer brutality of the state response.
And winning the Pulitzer for that in 1990, it wasn't just a career milestone, was it?
Yeah.
It sounds like it shaped his entire approach.
Absolutely. He talks about how that experience really drove home the idea that sometimes detached objectivity just isn't possible, or maybe even desirable. When you're facing a profound moral crisis, you can't just be a neutral observer.
It lit the fire for his advocacy.
You could say that. It certainly laid the groundwork for his core philosophy, which we can maybe call pragmatic moralism.
Okay, let's unpack that term. Pragmatic moralism. What does that mean in practice?
Well, it's this belief that positive change is possible, that you have to work towards it. But, and this is the pragmatic part, you have to accept that progress is messy. Hmm. It's slow. It's frustrating. There are always setbacks.
So it's hope, but it's a grounded hope, well, not naive optimism.
Exactly. He actively rejects cynicism. He sees it as, well, intellectually lazy, almost a moral failing. But his hope isn't blind. It's rooted in the difficult reality of how change actually happens.
That sounds like a vital mindset for anyone doing that kind of work, just to avoid burning out.
For sure. But how do you make that philosophy work in journalism? How do you make someone reading the paper actually care enough to do something?
That's the challenge, isn't it? Bridging the gap between the story and the reader's action.
And that's where Kristof is really strategic. He masterfully uses something called the identifiable victim effect.
Ah, right. The idea that we respond more strongly to an individual's story than to, like, big statistics.
Precisely. You hear a million people are starving and it's overwhelming. You almost shut down. The numbers are too big, too abstract.
It just becomes noise after a point.
Yeah. So Kristof zooms in. He finds one person, one story that illuminates the larger crisis. Like his reporting on sex trafficking, he tells the specific story of one Cambodian girl, Shreemom, sold into a brothel.
And that specific story cuts through the noise.
It ignites empathy. It makes the abstract problem feel real, human, urgent. He has this quote, something like, "Every statistic represents a person. Our job is to help readers see the person, not just the number."
That makes the reader feel connected, potentially empowered to act.
And this focus on the individual story, it also ties into how he sustains his own hope. This is central to the book's title, Chasing Hope.
How so?
He explicitly states that hope for him isn't just a feeling that comes and goes. He says hope is not a feeling. It's a discipline.
A discipline. Like something you have to actively practice.
Yes. It's a conscious choice to look for possibilities, to focus on what can be done, even when things look incredibly bleak. It's an act of will against despair.
Okay, but practically speaking, how do you practice that discipline day in, day out, when you're reporting on, say, genocide or famine? What's the tool?
His tool seems to be focusing on incremental progress, small wins. He often brings up the starfish parable.
Story about the person throwing starfish back into the ocean.
Yeah. Someone comes along and says, "You can't possibly save all of them. There are too many." And the person throws another one back and says, "Well, it made a difference to that one."
Right.
For Kristoff, that's not just a nice story. It's a survival strategy. It allows him to find meaning and value in the small, achievable act rather than being paralyzed by the enormity of the problem he can't solve entirely.
So it's about focusing on the impact you can have, however small.
Exactly. It protects against that overwhelming sense of futility.
That makes sense. Okay, let's talk about a major shift in his career. In 2001, he moves from being a foreign correspondent, a reporter, to an opinion columnist for the New York Times. Why was that change so significant?
That column basically unleashed him. As a reporter, there are, you know, constraints, the need for balance, sticking closer to the facts on the ground. As a columnist, he had the freedom to connect the dots, to make arguments, to explicitly call for action.
You could become more of a crusader.
Absolutely. And you really see that in his coverage of the Darfur genocide in the early 2000s. That campaign kind of defined his columnist role.
He won his second Pulitzer for that commentary, right?
He did, because he wasn't just reporting on the atrocities. He was using his platform to, as he put it, scream for international intervention, for policy changes. The column became a tool for direct advocacy.
But that kind of advocacy journalism, especially coming from a prominent Western journalist covering suffering elsewhere, it often draws criticism, doesn't it? The whole white savior critique.
Yes, and that's a really important, complex issue that he does address in the memoir. It's an ethical minefield.
What's the core of that critique?
The concern is that this model, a relatively privileged Western journalist focusing on the suffering of, often, people of color in developing nations, can risk reinforcing old power dynamics. It can seem like it centers the journalist's experience or intervention, potentially overshadowing local voices or solutions.
It's a valid concern about perspective and agency.
Definitely. And Kristoff acknowledges that. He doesn't dismiss the critique about optics or the potential pitfalls.
But he continues the work. So how does he justify it or reconcile it?
His argument ultimately comes down to moral urgency. He suggests that when faced with mass atrocities like genocide in Darfur or mass rape in Congo, the immediate imperative to bear witness, to sound the alarm, and to try and galvanize an international response that might actually save lives, well, that outweighs the risk of imperfect optics.
So the potential harm of silence is greater than the potential harm of speaking, even if the speaking isn't perfect.
That seems to be his calculus. That using the platform you have, even if it's flawed, is sometimes necessary to get powerful people to pay attention when they otherwise wouldn't. It's a difficult balance.
It really is. Okay, so he spends 2 decades building this incredibly influential column. And then, in 2021, he does something completely unexpected. He leaves the Times to run for governor of Oregon.
Yeah, a total pivot. Quite stunning, actually.
What was the motivation there? After all that time writing about problems, did you just want to try fixing them directly?
I think that was exactly it. You hear the frustration in his writing leading up to it. He'd been covering issues in his own backyard, the opioid crisis, devastating Yamhill, homelessness, rural poverty for years.
Right, bringing that international lens home.
And I think he reached a point where he felt like he'd written all he could. The next logical step for him seemed to be moving from documenting the problems to trying to implement solutions, from bearing witness to enacting change.
But it didn't work out. The campaign ended very quickly, didn't it?
Almost before it began, he was ruled ineligible because of a state residency requirement. It was a very public, you could say, humbling setback.
What does he say he learned from that experience? It must have been tough.
He's quite reflective about it. He talks about confronting the realities of the political machine, the rules, the compromises, the bureaucracy which is just so different from the moral clarity you can sometimes feel in journalism.
Politics is definitely messier.
Exponentially messier and slower. He seemed to gain a new appreciation for the constraints faced by policymakers. It wasn't just about having the right ideas, it was about navigating this incredibly complex system. And ultimately, it seemed to reinforce his commitment to journalism, but maybe with a more nuanced view of its limits and the limits of power itself.
So despite the political detour, his main legacy is still built on decades of reporting and commentary. What's the tangible impact that all this chasing hope actually changed things?
There's definitely evidence of what some call the Kristof effect. Huh. His columns often included direct appeals or information about specific aid groups working on the ground. And readers responded reportedly millions of dollars were donated directly as a result of his thesis.
Wow, that's direct impact.
Yeah. And beyond donations, his sustained focus on certain issues, especially global health and particularly gender equity, heavily influenced by his work with Cheryl Wudunn on books like Half the Sky, did contribute to policy shifts and increased international tension. He acted as this vital bridge, you know, taking these often hidden stories and putting them in front of people with the power to act.
That connection, bridging the powerful and the vulnerable, seems key.
Yeah.
And sometimes the most powerful connections are personal. Can you share that anecdote about the Cambodian survivor and the elephant? It really stuck with me.
Oh, yeah, that's a beautiful story. It really captures the reciprocity of bearing witness. He was reporting in Cambodia years after the Khmer Rouge genocide, interviewing survivors. And he spoke with this elderly woman who had lost almost everything. After she shared her incredibly painful story with him, she insisted on giving him a small, carved wooden elephant. It was one of the very few possessions she had left.
He must have felt awkward accepting it.
He did try to refuse, naturally, but she insisted, and her reasoning was profound. She explained that his act of listening, of truly seeing her and acknowledging her suffering, validating her story, that was more valuable to her than the object itself. The elephant was a token, a reminder for him of the connection they'd made.
So the act of witnessing itself was a form of aid, almost.
That's how she saw it. It shows that the human connection forged through that kind of empathetic journalism has value on both sides. It's not just extractive.
That's powerful. But the memoir doesn't shy away from the fact that sometimes the most challenging stories are the ones closest to home.
No, it doesn't. And perhaps the most gut-wrenching moment comes when he returns to Yamhill, his hometown, specifically to report on the opioid crisis tearing through rural America.
What happened there?
He discovered that a childhood friend, Mike, had died from an overdose just days before he arrived. He went to the funeral, and Mike's mother confronted him.
Oh, wow.
She asked him essentially why. Why did he travel the world covering distant tragedies when people were suffering and dying right here in the place he came from? Had he ignored his own community's pain?
That's devastating. What a question to face.
A total gut punch, as you said. And it forced him to really confront that question. He realized the despair, the lack of opportunity, the addiction he saw driving suffering in places like Darfur. Those same forces were at work in rural Oregon.
It collapsed the distance between over there and right here.
Completely. It drove home his core belief in the power of proximity. You have to get close, whether it's geographically or intellectually, to truly understand and care. And it proved that deep systemic suffering wasn't just a foreign problem. It demanded the same attention and empathy right where he stood.
So bringing it all together then, after immersing ourselves in Kristof's life and work through Chasing Hope, what are the main takeaways for us? For the listener,
I think we can distill it down to three core insights. First, an emotional insight. It's that power of proximity we just talked about. You can't truly connect or care from afar. Getting close, physically or emotionally, is essential for empathy.
Okay, proximity is key. What's the intellectual takeaway?
The intellectual insight has to be the value of pragmatic moralism, that vital balance. Rejecting cynicism, believing in change, but grounding that hope in the tough reality that progress is slow and incremental. It's hope with its eyes wide open.
Right. Hope is a strategy, not just a feeling.
Which leads perfectly to the third point, the universal insight. Hope is a discipline. It's an active daily choice. It's a functional tool for navigating overwhelming challenges, focusing on the difference you can make, like saving that one starfish.
Proximity, pragmatic moralism, and hope is a discipline. Powerful lessons. His entire career really argues against staying detached, doesn't it?
It really does. It's a call to engage, to bear witness in whatever way we can.
Well, thank you for guiding us through this deep dive into Nicholas Kristof and Chasing Hope. Really fascinating stuff.
My pleasure. It's a story worth wrestling with.
Definitely. And that brings us to our final provocative thought for you, our listener. Christoph often described journalism as a flashlight pointed into the world's dark corners. If you take his later lesson to heart, the need to bring that global lens home, ask yourself, what small, maybe overlooked corner of your own community, your own sphere of influence, needs that flashlight right now? Where is the hope worth chasing? Not somewhere else, but right here.
Join us next time for a new episode featuring another world-renowned individual, a new book, and a new idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.